You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on July 26, 2015 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Arsenal for Democracy columnist Diana and guest writer Maria join us to discuss common themes in the Sandra Bland story and coverage of Nicki Minaj. Then, co-host Kelly and I discuss prison reform, No Child Left Behind, and immigration. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. It's Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line from California, returning is Arsenal for Democracy's columnist, Diana. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us for the first time from Georgia is Maria, who did a guest post for us this week.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So this week, Kelly and I are going to be going over a lot of the stories that we've been covering on the blog at arsenalfordemocracy.com, specifically stories related to things that have been happening in the United States. I've also been doing, as usual, a lot of international coverage, and that's also available on arsenalfordemocracy.com, but we're probably not going to be talking about that on the show this week. Usually, we try to go pretty deep in depth on everything, but there's going to be a lot of things to cover, so some of the things we'll be going into more depth, and some of them we'll be going through a little bit more quickly, but you can read more about all of these on the blog at arsenalfordemocracy.com. So I want to start with the stories that our guests this week wrote from Diana and Maria. We've got a story that on the one hand seems kind of trivial, maybe, and, you know, fluffy or whatever. That's how certainly a lot of media sites covered it. And then we've got a very serious story. But we're going to talk about how these sort of fit together along with any number of other stories that that you've been writing about for us recently. So, Diana, let's start with your post about policing black women's emotions and opinions, specifically as it related to the quote-unquote feud between Nicki Minaj and Taylor Swift, which wasn't really a feud, but we'll talk about that. What exactly happened there?
Basically, what happened is the VMA nominations came out, and Nicki Minaj basically was pointing out an issue that the VMAs has had for a long time. The MTV VMAs, if you haven't paid attention to MTV at all, basically it's a music award show. And you would think because it's from MTV, it's a very important music award show. A lot of people would argue that in recent years it's not, but be that as it may, her video for Anaconda was a very, very record-breaking video as far as Vivo goes and internet views and memes and things like that. It had a huge cultural impact when it came out, but the video was actually snubbed at the VMAs, which the VMAs has a history of doing with a lot of black music and black artists. Nicki Minaj actually took to Twitter to talk about the situation, saying that it was kind of messed up for a video of that caliber to be ignored, where you have other videos that don't break as many records or that have women with specific body types who will get nominated for the World Award and even get nominated every year. But then you have her video, and because her video doesn't fit a certain aesthetic, she ends up getting snubbed. What ends up happening is Taylor Swift sees the series of tweets, and she sort of kind of takes it personally, thinking that Nicki Minaj is talking about her. And her reaction to it is basically to go, well, why are you attacking me? Maybe it was somebody else. Not understanding that Nicki Minaj wasn't talking specifically to her. She was talking about the system that's messed up. She was talking about the VMAs snubbing her and their history of snubbing women of color or women of size with their video nominations. And it turned into a huge thing in the media. It became a feud when really Nicki Minaj didn't really say anything about Taylor Swift. She certainly didn't call out Taylor Swift. She was calling out MTV.
And just to give some numbers to this, the various people then did studies, you know, formally or informally after these comments came out to try to figure out, you know, was Nicki Minaj's comments, you know, were they, as you said, based in the reality of the problems of the VMAs? A lot of these award shows are problematic for many, many reasons. But I believe Fusion put out a chart, a graphic of the breakdown of nominees for the Video of the Year Award from 1984 to present. It's overwhelmingly white men. I think more than half were of all nominees, of the 161 nominees were white men. It said only 26% were not white. Only 30% were women. There were not a lot of white women, but certainly more white women nominated than women of color. And then in terms of the winners, I mean, just, you know, overwhelmingly, has been awarded to white men. So as you said, this is not just coming out of nowhere. This was based in actual fact and was much bigger than, Taylor Swift. It seemed like also a lot of people didn't even wait around to see if there was a legitimate point being made. They just jumped in to defend Taylor Swift when it wasn't even about her in the first place.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And the problem with that is, one, what ended up happening was Nicki Minaj's whole point kind of got buried under all of that. And then the second thing that ended up happening is a lot of people attacked Nicki Minaj, saying that she should be humble and that she shouldn't act this way. And that even Taylor Swift said in her tweets that she was pitting women against each other, not understanding that Nicki Minaj is actually coming from a different place than Taylor Swift is coming from. Her experiences are different. And also, she shouldn't have to be humble. Like, nobody was out there telling Billy Corgan to be humble when Smashing Pumpkins was winning all of these awards for everything. So why would you tell Nicki Minaj when she's the most recognized and the most popular female rapper out there at the moment? And she's making, like she said, she's breaking records with her videos. She's going on world tours, all kinds of things. So why would she have to be humble? Why wouldn't she feel snubbed when she's has all these accomplishments but doesn't seem to be getting any recognition for it?
Now, one of the themes that you brought up in your post fairly briefly, but you've talked about in previous articles as well, was the concept of white feminism, which is not the same as white people who are feminists or feminists who are white. It's a specific, like, sub-genre, basically, of feminism, which is defined by its whiteness, I guess. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes, it really is, because a lot of times when you hear, especially if you see my post and you see me talk about white feminism, TM or whatever you want to call it, basically it's a kind of feminism that kind of disregards other experiences of other women and has a very white middle class sort of center. And so when you have things like a Rihanna music video where you can see her, where she's not wearing a whole lot of clothes, immediately that kind of feminism goes, well, that Rihanna video or that Nicki Minaj video or that Beyonce video isn't feminist because she's showing so much skin. But it's not understanding that Rihanna is a Caribbean woman or Nicki Minaj is a Caribbean woman doesn't have the same issues with nudity as, say, an American or a European white woman, or Beyonce talking about how pretty and how fabulous she is something that she had to work hard in order to be, maybe something that she had to work hard in order for her to be able to believe, because her looks and her appearance aren't as validated as much as middle class white women's are.
Now, you also mentioned in the post about Ida B. Wells and Sojourner Truth. Ida B. Wells was actually the subject recently of a Google Doodle, so a lot of people maybe who hadn't heard of her before found out about her. But you've written about her at some length as well. This, you pointed out, this seems to be a pattern that is not new. Like, this isn't just due to Twitter or something like that. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who want to try to, you know, say that some situation is just because of Twitter or is a new phenomenon. And your point was, no, I mean, this has been going on at least since the 19th century, if not longer.
Right. Because, like I said, with white feminism, it ignores intersection. So, like, with the post about Ida B. Wells, Ida B. Wells's big thing was she had seen so many friends and family members deal with lynchings, especially in her neighborhood. A friend of hers got lynched for being a competing grocer with another white man's grocery store. And the suffragettes that she would go to, you know, well, this is an issue for us. They would be like, well, sorry, we can probably get women's right to vote from these people who are hurting you. So we're just not going to worry about your problems. And that kind of seems to be like even today, the theme is the same. It's ignoring the intersection and going, well, I see that you have a problem, but it's not an important problem to me. I think we should focus on this first, and then just sort of pushing all of the other so-called outline issues on the side.
So it seems like two of the things that came up as sort of big picture issues here, I mean, many big picture issues came up, but two of them specifically that Maria then talked about in her post was this sort of not only silencing these experiences, but also automatically going to this place of saying that this complaint is unjustified, or that there should be, you know, they should quiet down, basically, not express their opinions, not express their anger over something. The situation with Sandra Bland, stemming from a traffic stop where allegedly she, you know, wasn't 100% compliant, or, you know, 100% cooperative, or, you know, 100% attitude free. This escalated to her then being arrested, and then she didn't have the $500 to make bail. And then she was found dead under very suspicious circumstances. A lot of that is still unclear what happened there, but based on sort of the sweeping arc of American history, a lot of people are wondering if she was murdered in the jail cell because she had, you know, shown this quote unquote attitude toward the police officer and everything. They're trying to say that it was a suicide. Maria, what was the connection that you made here between these two stories?
Well, between these two stories, there's definitely a connection of stereotyping Black women and their responses. For instance, the arresting officer in Senia described Bland as combative and uncooperative. And we saw a lot of descriptions of Nicki Minaj as being, as like attacking Taylor, or even with Amanda Stenberg and her whole thing with Kylie Jenner a couple of weeks back, she was accused of attacking her as well. So you often see Black women depicted as angry or bullies when that's nothing of the sort is happening.
And, you know, some people seemed like they thought that talking about one of these stories, you know, or talking about the pop cultural stories or whatever, was a distraction essentially from, you know, a very important story like Sandra Bland's. Did you see it as a distraction, or did you see it as something that could be discussed side by side?
These can absolutely be discussed side by side. People often will take stories like that and say they're distractions, or they're somehow trivial or not as important. And as I said in my essay, bricks make a wall. So each of these things matter, and they build up into this wall of misogynoir that Sandra Bland lost her life under.
Now, you also found a comparison to your experiences in the experiences that Sandra Bland had before. I think a lot of people actually were finding comparisons, or I should say specifically a lot of Black people were finding comparisons in their experiences to what she experienced prior to her death. You know, issues with seemingly minor run-ins with the police escalating into, you know, scary situations. We talked a lot about this on our panels about Ferguson, you know, with our guest Amma talking about, you know, getting pulled over constantly by the Ferguson Police Department, you know, while his kids are in the car, things like that. What were some of the comparisons, Maria, that you found in your experience to Sandra's experience?
Well, Sandra Bland and I are part of the same, you know, millennial generation. We both use Twitter and Facebook, and she was definitely active in the Black Lives Matter hashtag, and she made her own videos, Sandy Speaks, expressing her frustration with racism and giving voice to the movement that's been going on. And, you know, we've done the same things, you know, tweeted about it or made a video about it, used the same hashtags. We've also experienced the same kind of joblessness. I've been in a car thinking a cop, seeing a cop behind me thinking, oh, he must not be here for me, and moving over. And it, you know, very easily could have been a very similar situation.
Right, because as I understand it, they tried to claim that she had changed lanes without using a turn signal, but her version of events was that she was pulling over to let the police officer get by because she assumed that she wasn't the one being pulled over.
Correct.
Yeah, that, I mean, the whole situation's crazy. And then there was the whole issue of the doctored tape and everything, or whether or not it was doctored, and all kinds of things aren't really adding up about this. One of the really bizarre things that happened was that Anderson Cooper, I guess, asked Donald Trump his opinion on this. And like, then people were passing around the video of that because it was like, you know, Donald Trump was saying that he thought that the situation was totally mishandled and that the police were out of line, etc. But then, of course, because he's Donald Trump, you know, and this is his MO for the past, you know, 25, 30 years or whatever, maybe even longer, followed that up by saying that, you know, he was a huge fan of the police in general, that this was some kind of, you know, outlier perhaps, and that the police should be given more powers, not less, you know, to fight crime or whatever you want them to do. So, I mean, that part wasn't necessarily surprising, but I mean, it seems like a lot of people are definitely, you know, not just folks, black folks, but a lot of folks in general are outraged about what happened. But it seems like some of them aren't really understanding that, again, this isn't some sort of isolated incident, that this isn't, you know, an outlier, that this is part of a just recurring pattern. I mean, just constant harassment, often leading to, you know, fatalities. I don't know if either of you, Deanna or Maria, had thoughts on that particular angle.
Well, that's absolutely right. We see these attacks on Nicki Minaj and then, well, we see these articles on Nicki Minaj and Amanda Stenberg saying basically the same things about them. And we see the same arguments being made about Sandra Bland as well. So it's not just pop culture, but it's also law enforcement and that whole system. And they're working together using the same stereotypes to attack these women. And it can either be just through articles, or you could actually end up being pulled over by police and losing your life.
And one of the things that like you said, that connects everything is like there's this idea that there was something that Sandra Bland could have done in order to stop the situation, that she should have maybe not have had an attitude, even though there was no reason for her to be pulled over, that she should have cooperated with the police, even though in the video you see that you hear her complaining about how he hurt her. He hit her in the head, or she had hit her head on the floor or something. And she's complaining about pain, and he shows no sympathy for her. And so you have these situations going on, and people will go, oh, well, it's just because she had an attitude. It's just because of this. It's just because of that. But they're not paying attention to the fact that even when people are complying with the police, stuff still goes wrong. And it's a lot of people just don't know. Or either they don't know or they don't care. And it's kind of sad. But at the same time, this isn't new. This isn't something that just started happening. This is something that's been going on for a while, and people are just in denial about it.
And the words the officer used, even, that he could just pull her out of the car and light her up.
Right, threatening to tase her for basically not being totally polite in his opinion. Which, again, I mean, it's his, like, it's all dependent on his interpretation of the situation. She could even object, you know, almost objectively be doing everything right. And if he's having a bad day or something, you know, the whole thing falls apart. I mean, I don't want to get too far off topic, but that's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately in general, is just this issue of like how, like, we have a whole system that is set up that supposedly, you know, you've got rule of law and the same laws are supposed to apply to everyone. But then you have the people saying, oh, well, we should have a more personalized system, you know, that takes, you know, takes that human factor into account. But it almost seems like that's not working either, because the more flexibility that we add into the system, it's actually introducing the risk of abuse, that it's introducing possibility for those bad apples to, you know, take advantage of the situation and not apply the rules consistently. You know, I think there's been studies, I don't have one in front of me, but I think there's been studies about like that sentencing in courts changes dramatically based on whether or not the judge has had lunch before or after, like things like that are so arbitrary can lead to these like huge disparities. And the system, like in general, I mean, that's not necessarily like racially specific, but you know, that there's a lot of these things that are too dependent on how an individual person behaves in a situation, whether it's the person in power or the person that's being detained or questioned or whatever, that just seems to create all these sort of problems. And I also just find it remarkable that, you know, it's not surprising, but it's remarkable that we've got all these folks who don't seem to think that there's a problem here. I mean, you know, some of them maybe are just racists or deep down are racist or something. But even in general, like, even if there weren't a racial component here, which there clearly is, I mean, they seem like a lot of people seem really comfortable with police killing a ton of people every year in the United States. That's like a very strange thing to just accept at face value. I had done a big post in December last year on arsenalfordemocracy.com about Utah's homicide by police epidemic. I mean, that's a very, very white state. And they're like, they don't have very many murders. It's very safe in general. But there was this like whole Salt Lake Tribune report where they found that 15% of all homicides in Utah from 2010 to October 2014 were at the hands of police. I mean, really? Like, that's an acceptable level that you had, you know, 15% of all your homicides were committed by the police? Like, I don't understand why so many people are just cavalierly accepting this. And then you add back in that racial component, and it's just like, oh, well, like, real, that seems to be the response of so many people. Or they do, you know, something I saw on Twitter was black people are saying, please stop killing us. And then white people are responding, but, or actually, it's like, really? That's your response to that? That you just automatically, in every situation, try to find some excuse that is like erasing this out. It doesn't make any sense.
I think it shows what different experiences people have with the police. That if you grew up in a suburb with a friendly police officer that visited your school once a year with this cute dog, if your next door neighbor was the beloved police chief, you know, you're going to have one very strong attitude about the police. And I think it reaches into that problem we always run against, that people don't want to hear facts or stories that don't completely mesh up with their personal experience. And if their personal experience has been one of favor with the police, it's easier just to ignore these facts as well as these heartbreaking stories about what's happening to other Americans.
I think that one of the things that needs to happen is, one, we need to get rid of this idea that the police are these altruistic superheroes, that as soon as they put on a uniform or a badge, they're these altruistic superheroes who are there to uphold the law. They're still human beings. Their prejudices, their emotions, those things can affect how they police. And unfortunately, because we live in the United States, there are a lot of prejudices, especially against black people and black women and other marginalized people, that kind of bleed into the work that they're doing. And so it's a cycle where marginalized people continue to have bad interactions with the police because the police expect it. And it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think we need to get rid of the idea that the police are these altruistic good guys and start working towards understanding that they're human, and then also making a system where they're not allowed to do these terrible things and get away with it.
And also coming to terms with the history of how police began in the United States, how they began as night patrols to hunt after Native Americans or escaped slaves, and realizing that this whole idea of repairing a relationship can't really be possible if there was no good relationship to begin with.
And especially if you won't even acknowledge the fact that there's an issue in the first place. A lot of the repairing the relationship narrative is like, well, you guys should trust the police more. And it's like, well, there are all of these things that have been happening between us and the police. You have to also not kill us in order for us to be able to repair this relationship.
Right. They haven't done the prerequisite for like that, any relationship to be built or rebuilt there. They haven't taken that first step. But yeah, I think it's important to realize how all these stories fit together. As Maria said, it's like putting bricks together in a wall that is, you know, adding up to this much bigger situation. You know, we didn't even really touch on, and folks can read about it more on arsenalfordemocracy.com, but the idea that because black women are perceived so often as angry or aggressive or threatening, you know, whether it's tweeting something that's not about Taylor Swift or whatever, or, you know, in a traffic stop, that then you get the, you know, this policy of forcibly containing, excessively forcibly containing situations that might not even be situations in reality. You know, and Deanna's written about the McKinney pool situation in also in Texas, where that police officer, you know, was basically more or less ignoring or just lightly handcuffing some of the white kids who were there. But then, you know, slamming a teenage black girl to the ground when, you know, she clearly was not any kind of threat. I mean, he's a much bigger than her, and she was trying to leave the situation, and she was wearing a swimming suit, was clearly not carrying any weapons, like that kind of stuff happening all the time, over and over and over again. I mean, just like, you know, like Maria said, all these bricks adding up, fitting together into this big picture situation. All right. Well, that is going to bring us to the end of this segment. Deanna, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me back.
And Maria, thanks for being on for the first time.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right. Well, we will talk to you both very soon, I'm sure. And again, folks can read those essays at arsenalfordemocracy.com. We will be right back with more from WVUD in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Still in studio with me is Kelly. We're going to be talking now about some U.S. stories that Kelly has been focusing on in the past week or so on arsenalfordemocracy.com. And specifically, we're going to start by talking about the topic of prison reform. So what was the big story with that in the past couple weeks?
Sure. So President Obama essentially went on a prison reform blitz. He became the first sitting U.S. president to ever visit a federal prison, and he has been calling a lot of attention to mandatory minimums, many of which were enacted in the 1980s, many of which have since been repealed, but there are still people in prison serving terms under these mandatory minimums. So he's commuted 89 men and women just on July 14th, all of whom were serving for nonviolent drug crimes. And he used this opportunity not just to commute these sentences, but to bring attention to the fact that there are men and women sitting in federal prisons who don't necessarily need to be there. It's not making the country any safer to have them there. They've served their time. Their punishments were disproportionate to the crimes they committed. And he believes that we can improve the criminal justice system by letting these people go. So after commuting those sentences, he went on to talk in front of the NAACP about prison reform and cited really specific policies, even as specific as talking about solitary confinement and the inhumanity of that and the dangerousness of keeping somebody in solitary confinement for so long and then sending them back out into society.
And that's been in the news recently because of folks like Khalif Browder and others who, you know, in his particular case, not only was he in prison for no reason, he was picked up by the, you know, for the fitting the description and wasn't the person who had done anything and then never got a trial one way or another and then was suddenly released. And he had been in Rikers Island, which is fairly dangerous prison in general. But he'd been in solitary a lot of time, probably, you know, quote unquote, for his own protection. And then he ultimately committed suicide after getting out because he had had a lot of mental health issues developing from being a teenager in solitary confinement. And this has also been, you know, certain states have been reevaluating this. In Colorado in particular, it's a hot button issue. I know I've written about this as well on the website. But basically in Colorado, they had a Department of Corrections director was actually murdered in his home by someone who was, I think, mistakenly released or something, but had spent most of his time in solitary confinement and maybe shouldn't have been in solitary confinement and had basically snapped mentally and then, like, got let out and went and killed the guy. And so then the next person who took over that job said that he was going to spend a lot of time reevaluating that, you know, going and spending some time in solitary confinement himself to see what that experience was like. And a lot of this, it's this, you know, that it's being abused in general, being used for people that shouldn't be in there at all. And then just, you know, it, like you said, it's not making anybody safer. It's actually potentially making people more dangerous if they then are, you know, released back into the general population of not the prison general population, but the actual population of the country.
Yeah. One thing I thought was really interesting is that for decades, politicians were trying to get tough on crime. And under President Obama, Eric Holder tried to the Attorney General, Eric Holder tried to change the conversation to getting smart on crime. Again, accepting that there are people who spend their whole lives studying our criminal justice system and ways to reform them. And one third of the Justice Department's budget goes towards these federal prisons. And one of Obama's points during his NAACP speech was that think of what we could do with that money if we tried to use it to keep people out of prison by trying to prevent recidivism and keeping kids in school instead of just paying for it on the other end when they're sitting for years and years and years eating up tax dollars.
Yeah, and I think also there was a lot of issues that came up during his tour about things like overcrowding. That's been a big problem. Mm-hmm. You know, he was focusing, I think, mainly on, you know, nonviolent drug offenders. So then that brings up issues about the war on drugs. But of course, there's also at this point a much larger prison population, especially because of issues like privatization of prisons, making them for profit. You get a lot of people who aren't even in there on drug related things. There are other nonviolent offenses. So even, you know, even ending that wouldn't necessarily fix this overnight. But you've got these prisons are really crowded. Also, you know, even for as much as we've seen increasing sort of television coverage, you know, on, you know, of various shows and dramas and things, you know, either being set in prisons or featuring prisons as part of storylines. The Good Wife in particular, I've been watching some of that recently and noticing that there's been a number of plot lines about, you know, prison causing more problems than it's solving, or, you know, making people more dangerous, or not, you know, doing enough to protect people who haven't actually done anything. For all of that sort of presence, I don't think the conversation has fundamentally been changed yet in the United States about, like, what should our prisons be like? You know, should they be these intolerable hellholes, or should there be sort of tiers? And, you know, if you're, you know, that if you're in there for relatively minor things, that it should be basically a timeout and maybe some focused work on, you know, getting you to think about what you did wrong and what you can do better next time so you don't land back in there. And I think everyone still is in the mindset of prison should be as awful as possible and, you know, just constantly terrible. And I think, you know, they're thinking of it in terms of, like, the murderers and rapists. I don't think they're thinking of it in terms of, like, the lower level people who, you know, if you put someone in there for, you know, even 2 years or whatever, that's like 2 years of potentially being just traumatized on a daily basis and, like, constantly literally looking over your shoulder to make sure no one's going to kill you or something like that. And we haven't really, like, reassessed how we conceive of prisons. Like, you know, a lot of the European countries have, you know, they get made fun of for having, you know, arguably kind of cushy prisons in some cases. And maybe you can see why it doesn't necessarily need to be like a 4-star resort or whatever if someone's a mass murderer. But there are levels of offenses. And I think for many people, you know, putting them in a 2-year timeout from their career and limiting what they get to do, but also keeping them safe and not making their life, you know, completely destroyed essentially, and their mental health destroyed, like, that might be a better approach to preventing recidivism.
Right. And those two prisoners in upstate New York who escaped recently, that was bad. Prisoners should not escape. But one thing that I thought was really disappointing that came out of that was sort of the trashing of these honor block cells, where prisoners could wear you know, normal clothes and had more freedom over how they spent their day, were able to interact with each other more. It's bad that they escape, but on a systems level, it is good that those honor block cells exist because they prepare prisoners who have been in prison maybe for a long time, maybe not, but they prepare them to re-enter the world where they're going to have to seek employment and decide how they spend their days and decide how they are going to be productive with their time and interact with different kinds of people. Those are all skills that prisoners need to have when they re-enter society. And so those otter blocks give them a good chance to practice those skills in a safeguarded environment. And it was disappointing to see the state of New York turn their back so quickly because of two bad people and a whole bunch of people willing to, be enablers in that situation.
Yeah, so, I mean, prison reform is obviously a complicated topic, and there's lots more we could talk about, but a new approach and a new rethinking, I think, would is much overdue at this point. I'll put it that way. Okay, let's turn now to No Child Left Behind. This is an area, education reform, that's always a hot topic as well. But No Child Left Behind has been on the back burner for like, 8 years after it expired or something?
8 years.
And they're finally getting around to trying to replace it with something. There's been a House version that's passed. There's been a Senate version that's passed. They are completely not in line with each other at all. So this is still an ongoing debate. But I want to talk a little bit about the Senate bill, because that seems to be the one that was a lot more bipartisan and had broader support, unlike the House bill, which barely passed. I think it was a one vote margin, and you know, they couldn't even get all the Republicans on board, and no Democrats voted in favor of it, as far as I know. What was the deal with the Senate bill? Why did so many people vote for it, and why did a few Democrats vote against it?
Yeah, so as you said, strong bipartisan support, 81-17. So clearly a lot of people in favor of this bill, believing that it's better than the existing No Child Left Behind legislation. So the three Democratic senators that voted against it were Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, and Cory Booker of New Jersey. And essentially their biggest problem with the bill as it exists now is that there's not enough accountability, especially in terms of how states and schools are serving more diverse populations. So Chris Murphy of Connecticut introduced the quote-unquote Murphy Amendment that is getting no play in the press, but is essential to understanding their problem with the bill. So he was calling for states to identify schools that required intervention, which was essentially the lowest 5% of schools in the state, as long as high schools were at least 2/3 of the kids were not graduating or were graduating, and any school where disabled, poor, or English language learners were not meeting the state set goals. So really still leaving a lot of power in the states. States could determine how they were going to figure out the lowest 5% of schools. Testing scores did have to be part of that equation, but states could determine how much of that equation the test scores were. So some people did not like this amendment because they're saying it keeps it too much like No Child Left Behind. Those three Democrats were saying, hey, we need some sort of accountability. Testing is the easiest way to do it. And unlike No Child Left Behind, they were not planning on pulling funding for these schools or shutting them down, just requiring them to meet with their state to set up sort of long-term goals and plans for improving their schools.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's going in the wrong direction or throwing the baby out with the bathwater if you ditch accountability altogether. I'm not a big fan of the testing, but you have to have some way of assessing objectively, like comparing different, you know, schools to each other, right, or whatever, or else what's the point of any of this? But, you know, I agree that the No Child Left Behind approach that they're trying to replace also didn't work, of cutting funding based on that or whatever.
Yes, of course. I personally am a fan of testing once in middle school and once in high school. I think those test scores will give you the numbers that you need to figure out if your programs are working without, you know, testing every year, taking up days of school time, not to mention the quote unquote teaching and the test to the test, which everyone is scared of. But there does need to be some way to figure out whether or not these programs are working. And in many ways, when we ignore accountability, we have no way to figure out who these programs are failing. And these three Democratic senators in particular were worried about minority groups. And
low-income students.
Yeah, minority groups and low-income students, which have traditionally been failed by public schools. If there's no way to measure how they're doing, then there's no way to measure the success of the bill.
So you said at the end of this post that this is probably going to continue in the debate, even though it didn't make it into the first Senate bill that passed. Where do you see this going in terms of trying to get the House on board, the Senate on board, the White House on board? I mean, they seem like they're in pretty different places at this point, because the White House had supported the Murphy Amendment and that didn't pass. And then the Senate passed a bill without it. And then the House passed a bill that the White House said it would veto. So where are we at with this overall?
Yeah, there's a long road ahead. And I think essentially Obama, President Obama and Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, are going to, sit with that veto pen and threaten that for as long as possible so that they can get this bill to be like they would be. So essentially what we're going to see in this bill is a lot more power returning to the states. That is going to be, I think, the biggest way that is different from No Child Left Behind. States are going to be able to determine how they test their schools, what defines a failing school and a succeeding school, and how that sort of thing. That accountability is still the big question mark, that people are scared of the word testing. The Common Core has scared off a lot of people when it comes to federally mandated education requirements. So that is the big question mark. There's not a lot of accountability measures in the bill from the House of Representatives, a little bit more so in the Senate, but not very much at all. And President Obama is saying he's really going to require some accountability, and hoping to make this a big civil rights bill so that we can serve students who have typically not been served as they deserve. So a long road ahead, a lot of competing philosophies, but I think we'll see that power will continue to reside in the states more so than it did in No Child Left Behind. And that big accountability question will be debated in the weeks to come.
I think one of the issues, I don't have a lot of evidence for this, but this is my supposition, is that, when No Child Left Behind was passed, I think a lot more Republicans and Democrats were on board with the idea of accountability and sort of mechanisms for checking this. I think what's changed now is that there were some ways of gauging states against each other because of No Child Left Behind. And I think some people did not like where their states landed on those charts. Some of them were not big surprises. Massachusetts and New Jersey consistently ending up at the top. They spend a lot of money on education, especially at the local level. Other areas, I will leave them nameless, but they spend more on their high school stadiums than on their academic budgets. That's literally happens in a lot of places. They will spend millions of dollars paying their head coaches for football and, building football stadiums and stuff. And they will end up spending more on that than they actually spend on education. And, you hear people saying, don't throw money at the problem. That's a common talking point. But at a certain point, if you throw money at the problem, it will get better when it comes to education. If you're starting at a point of spending almost no money on it and spending it on other things instead. I think some people maybe are kind of reluctant in the Senate and House to support some of these measures because they would prefer not to be compared to other states, even though we are all trying to pull together on these oars.
I just feel that the federal government does need to step in to some degree when it comes to education. There was recently a study from Botswana that, showed once again that if you keep a child in school for another year, their risk of contracting HIV decreases dramatically. Obviously not how it's playing out right here in the States, but there's just continually proof that education is the key to health later in life. It's the key to employment later in life. It's the key to your kids getting an education. And, I think a child born in one of those unnamed states with awesome football stadiums, you know, deserves a chance just as much as a child born in New Jersey or Massachusetts. So I think the federal government does owe it to its citizens. And I think it's good for the country if we have an educated population. So we need to figure out how we can work together to come up with a standard of what we think children in our nation deserve.
All right, let's move on to immigration now and some of the stories related to undocumented or unlawful immigration that have come up. What's been going on there besides the political talking points in the presidential race?
We need Donald Trump for this section. So the first story to sort of hit the news waves was the birth certificate story. The 14th Amendment says quite clearly, and this is the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution, says quite clearly that people born in the borders of the United States are naturalized citizens. However, some counties in Texas have decided that while those children, babies, may be naturalized citizens,
natural born citizens,
they are not going to get birth certificates because those states are now requiring that if a parent comes to register their child and get a birth certificate for their child, they want to see a U.S. visa inside any foreign passport. So it used to be that you didn't need a U.S. visa to get your child a birth certificate. A few county clerks are saying you need a... So what's happening is that there are a lot of children without birth certificates now in some of those border counties of Texas. And that's dangerous because a parent now has no way to prove that a child is their own. They can't be registered for kindergarten. The parents are having a very hard time at the doctor's office. These babies aren't getting any of the services they need because according to these clerks, these babies do not exist. So there's a class action lawsuit happening right now in Texas, but just goes to show you, you know, how heated the immigration debate really is down there, that they are going to fly in the face of the 14th Amendment and deny babies born on U.S. soil birth certificates because their parents do not have proper documentation to be in the United States.
Yeah, and I know it's been a hot button issue, specifically the automatic citizenship, but we've had this since 1868, guys. This isn't controversial. If someone is born in the United States, they're eligible for automatic U.S. citizenship. You know, I mean, there's a few exceptions, like if you're born on, you know, diplomatic soil or whatever, or if your parents decide to, you know, they're just visiting or something and they apply for citizenship in their home country instead. I don't know if you'd be able to then later go back and say, well, I was born within the borders of the U.S., so therefore I should. But this is not that situation. This is straightforward. This is just kids, as usual, being born in the United States. And it really doesn't matter what their parents' documentation situation is, at least not to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment says that that every person who is born in the United States is eligible for citizenship automatically, that they are citizens, not even to apply, you know, that they automatically are citizens. And, you know, they just have to get the paperwork together, but they don't need paperwork from their parents. That's not part of the deal.
And this story is even more horrifying when it's coupled with the other stories regarding immigrants coming out of Texas, one of which is that at a children's detention center, children were given an adult dose of hepatitis A, which is very dangerous for children, and were then the solution to that, unfortunately, they were just told to drink lots of water, which people in the detention center are complaining that's their solution for everything, drink more water. The stories of unaccompanied minors reaching the U.S. was getting a lot of press a year ago. It has since died down, but those children are still in these detention centers. And this is just an example of how we're still not quite sure what to do with them or, you know, how to provide for them. And unfortunately, while the press has died down, those children are still sitting there. And the third story was these mass graves of immigrants being found in Texas. The journey to the U.S. is very dangerous, and many people die even once they cross that border. as they have to walk through very hot conditions for days and days. So people are dying, and apparently their bodies have been picked up and stored in this mass grave where there's possibly hundreds and hundreds of unidentified bodies. Texas says that they did no legal wrongdoing. Other people say otherwise, but I think at the end of the day, there are these mass graves of immigrants. And like we've been talking about intersectionality since the beginning of the show, the attitudes that have led to police brutality and the attitudes that have led to, you know, maybe Nicki Minaj not getting the accolade she deserves, are the same attitudes that are contributing to, you know, sort of the nonchalance of dumping hundreds of bodies into a grave. So immigration is a real thing, and we have to figure out how we're going to deal with it, and we have to come up with a better process for dealing with it, because mass graves giving are not acceptable. Denying children birth certificates are not acceptable. Giving the wrong doses of vaccines are not acceptable. So we sort of all need to come to the table as, you know, common sense individuals and figure out what we're going to do.
All right. Well, it looks like we're out of time for this week's episode. But again, if you want to know more about these stories that we've been talking about all hour long, you can go to arsenalfordemocracy.com and read all about those. Kelly, thank you for joining me in studio again this week.
Thanks for having me.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at arsenalfordemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.